everybody. Welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, and this is part two of the West Memphis 3 series covering the murders at Robin Hood Hills back on May 5th, 1993. But before we jump into the story, I want to say thank you to everybody who's been listening to my show. I've put out a lot of content in the first couple of months, and the response has been great. On that note, though, as I've mentioned before, there's a price that comes with doing the type of ridiculous and unflinching psychological analysis I'm willing to undertake in the face of criticism. And that price can sometimes be high. But what really makes it worth my while is that every time somebody tries to drag me under, there's another listener right there willing to lift me up. So again, you have my greatest appreciation for your feedback and 5-star Apple Podcast ratings. Also, please remember to follow me on Twitter, @ColdCaseMM, and on Instagram, @ColdCaseMurderMysteries. And that's enough of that. Let's go to Arkansas. Now, the first thing I want to do while there is plant this seed in your mind. It's a verse from the Bible. Quote, "In my name, they will pick up snakes with their hands." End quote. And that summarizes everything I'm about to discuss with you now. So, again, it's the late afternoon of May 5th, 1993, in West Memphis. For those who aren't familiar with the southeastern part of the United States, it tends to be quite warm and especially humid. Now, you might not experience the extremes of this type of weather in May, but generally this is an area where you're going to get what most would consider summer weather at an earlier point than you would in, say, New York or Chicago. And that seems to be the case on this afternoon. The temperature was supposedly in the low 80s, and you'd have light later into the evening, but not in the way you would in the latter part of June, where it could extend to 9 p.m. So, we have three second graders by the names of Christopher Byers, Stevie Branch, and Michael Moore, who are all Cub Scouts. And before I proceed, I want to point out that this sequence in which I've posed the boys' names is so revealing from a psychological standpoint that I feel like I could end the show right now with that as sole proof of who committed this crime. But seriously though, as I said in part one, this crime was a reflection of someone's pain, and that's why the evidence was submerged, but the truth still rose to the surface. Here's the thing. Those names are most frequently posed in that order, with Christopher Byers first, Stevie Branch second, and Michael Moore third. So what do we need to do to understand the psychology of this message? We get out a mirror. And now that we have those names in front of a mirror, what do we get? They're reversed. Then it becomes Michael Moore, Stevie Branch, and Christopher Byers. This is where we establish the distinction between the two. In the context of people discussing the murders, whether law enforcement or those who have a casual interest in true crime, Christopher Byers has gained far more notoriety than his counterparts due to the severity of his injuries, specifically the disputed castration, or mutilation, of his genitals. The psychology behind this is very simple, of course. Mutilation of the reproductive area of a healthy human who could be expected to contribute to future generational offspring is a direct attack on evolution's plight that specifically has long-term repercussions that are permanent and born of loss, paralleled by the way the murder is received physically by the victims and emotionally by their surviving family and friends. So then Stevie Branch garnered the next level of interest down. What seems to have been the most prevalent about comments regarding him is that he would have turned out a ladies' man had he been graced with the opportunity to grow to adulthood. The pictures of him seem to indicate he had a magnetic personality and a great smile. The big controversy with Stevie's injuries, as they were examined for years in the aftermath of the murders, and in multiple contexts, is that some experts claim a few of them are actually bite marks. There's one in particular, around his eye socket, that appears that it could have been made by a human mouth. And finally, we have Michael Moore, who is generally the least talked about of the three because he died from injuries similar to the other boys, but in the absence of the same controversy regarding specific elements that are incredibly sensational to journalists and police alike, such as bite marks and castration. But here's the truth about Michael Moore. He was the leader of this group. It was widely known. So why does he seem to almost be an afterthought? Mirrors. Like I just said a minute ago, the murders mirrored the pain of the killer, even to the extent the victims mirrored that which was lost by the killer. Even if there's more than one of them, one is still dominant and leads the way in the event. It's fueled by these emotions, whether alone or with accomplices. The accomplices need only do two things, which are innate to our being. One, they have to relate. And two, they have to want to be led. So that brings us to this mirror. Check this out. We're all on bikes right now in West Memphis, like a bunch of kids. We're riding north from Stevie Branch's house, where we'll pass the homes of neighbors Christopher Byers and Michael Moore. About a half mile north of there is Robin Hood Hills, where we enter the tree line and learn a couple of things. The forest consists of 4 acres, and running down the middle of it is a large drainage pipeline that essentially cuts the woods in half. And already I'm making a mental note of this because I know one thing for sure. Home field advantage is a real thing. In sports, in war, and in everything, including examination. So we aren't going to talk about blue candle wax found at the scene that matches a candle from Damien Eccles' home, because it's just not that significant. And the single hair of an African-American man found near one of the bodies? So what? This case is just chock full of interesting evidence that reveals absolutely nothing in the way of truth. It's a dead end, and half the people listening right now, like myself, have banged their heads into the wall so many times this case has made them dizzy. So, for lack of a better term, we need to create an abstraction, something that places the circumstances within a vacuum that's conducive to comprehending the event in the context of its natural environment, and also the predator in the context of the act of killing its prey. So, now we arrive here at the edge of the woods, and clearly the light dims as we enter, giving the first visual indication of the magical secret world we discussed in the previous episode, the one where kids escape the adult world and pretend. The temperature cools a bit. Our eyes try to adapt to the low light, but the silence gives us an eerie feeling that something not only sees better than we do, but that it's looking right at us in our ignorance. So we tread carefully, moving toward the crime scene, and something about the landscape, about that drainage pipe running through the middle, is screaming symbolism, something old, something primal. And then it hits me. Origin. It's something about the origin of the predator. The landscape parallels the origins of the guilty predator in this crime. If I can identify the predator by way of symbolism, then I should be able to correlate its identity to its place of origin. And then, if we find a geographical match, in terms of the parallels of the landscape there as compared to Robin Hood Hills, we'll know the psychology of this assumption about the predator and its prey is genuine. But how do we get there? As I've already stated, we follow the trail of parallels and symbolism. So in this case of murder, where we don't have the privilege of actually seeing the predator in action, we follow the trail to what got us here. Mirrors. So where is this mirror? Oh look, the gully is up ahead. Again, this is just a drainage ditch, wider in some areas than others, and with varying depths that go down to about 8 feet. There are muddy banks on either side that slope to the water. That's it. As we're standing here looking down at the water, I realize I see my reflection. This is the mirror. So, if the psychological pain of the killer mirrored what he killed, then the answer, by default of the psychology, will be that the truth of the predator's identity is buried beneath the surface. And as we also said, it's going to rise, by default of symbolic and psychological implications present in our brains. So if the truth rises from a mirror that buries the secrets, then the body should do so in a manner that parallels the way the boys were remembered not in death, but in reverse, as they were remembered in life. And the truth of everything should be evidenced in the symbolism apparent. Accordingly, as the first detective to enter the water scours the murky gully, the first boy to come out of the water is the one remembered as the group's leader, Michael Moore. But let's re-examine the symbolism there. I said the truth would rise to the surface, and what actually did rise to the surface was the leader of a group of 3 boys. So if the cops were to view this event in retrospect, they could easily draw the conclusion that what they were actually doing during that time, even if in their ignorance, is looking for the truth about the leader of a group of 3 boys. And here they also learn why he was killed, because the evidence mirrors the pain of the murderer. We have a child, we have bindings, we have drowning, and we have death. So to summarize, the death of his childhood left the killer feeling bound, drowning, and permanently unable to enter adulthood. So let's add 1 + 1 here and observe the synergy. The cops were looking for the truth about the leader of a group of 3 boys and learned he'd been bound and drowning, permanently unable to enter adulthood due to what he suffered. That's Michael Moore. But my point is this. It's also Damien Eccles. And all prison is, at its core, is a place for kids who could never become adults. Accordingly, where does Damien Eccles end up? Just like Michael Moore? In a place where he never has the freedom to become an adult. But why mirrors? Why have I chosen to utilize this tool? The answer is that the rage we release is actually a reflection of the inadequacy we internalize. Therefore, what we find in these 2 leaders of 3 boys, Michael Moore and Damien Eccles, is that they are polar opposites. Damien is antisocial, whereas Cub Scout Michael Moore is communal in nature. Eccles portrays apathy, while the leadership qualities of Michael Moore dictate participation. Michael was a good student, and Damien was a high school dropout. So Damien had every reason to be jealous of this kid who was everything he never had the courage to be, as Michael's positive qualities shine a light directly on his inadequacy and the youth that has slipped through his grasp. So right there we find an open door we can slip in. Inadequacy. Let's go inside and take a look around. The psychology of inadequacy dictates that an outburst related to it must focus its rage at that which is most symbolic of its cause. Now let's take that notion and relate it to the murders in a simple way, like this. We ask ourselves which kid got it the worst. Now, they all died horrifying deaths, so this doesn't seem to be a great question. But I think it would be quite fair to say Christopher Byers, considering that his genitals were mutilated and he likely bled out, was the object of the rage. This is essentially what initially led John Mark Byers to become a suspect, at least in terms of the Second Paradise Lost documentary, the fact that there's a greater chance for violence among adoptive fathers and stepfathers than there is among biological fathers. Okay, now, to get the answer here, we need to go back in the water and find the other 2 kids. So, as the central figure of 3 in a mirrored image would be unaffected in that process visually, accordingly, we get the body of Stevie Branch coming out next. And finally, Christopher Byers is last. Now, these supposed bite marks on Branch aren't noticed until much later, so there isn't any speculation occurring about such a thing at this point. He appears to have died in much the same way as Michael Moore. But then they get to the body of Christopher Byers and take it to the bank of the gully and realize something. Unlike the other boys, as mentioned, his genitals are mutilated. Now, we have some discrepancy among different reports of this, but the most common interpretation is that the scrotum was essentially removed, the tip of the penis was missing, and the shaft was flayed. Needless to say, this was a severe injury, one that was later attributed to animal predation by high-priced defense experts made possible by celebrity dollar signs, but one that clearly shows evidence of this, an attack. So while snapping turtles easily could have caused this injury, we know it's bullshit by the nature of what happens next. The defense continues to try to explain it away with other forms of animal predation, to the extent that we ultimately get an outrageous and hilarious assertion that the injuries to the boys were caused by dogs ravaging their bodies. The testimony regarding this point of contention spun way out of control, and tried way too hard. And the reason is this. The answer as to the cause of this injury is innate to the psychology of the crime. I already told you what it is. I just need you to place it in front of a mirror so we can see it in the proper context. It's one word. Inadequacy. In the context of being unable to become a man. Damien Eccles, at 18 years of age, a high school dropout who had a pregnant girlfriend and was, at best, working part-time as a roofer on occasion and walking aimlessly around town full of anxiety, was unable to become a man, but was about to be bestowed with the responsibilities of such, whether he liked it or not, by way of his pregnant girlfriend. So he becomes angry at this notion because it's actually a countdown with a definitive timeline, one where he knows almost to the day when he's going to start having to act like a man. And he's angry about it. So where does he direct his anger? At the root cause. His dick. And what does Christopher Byers, as we've already discussed, represent? The innocence of childhood, which is free of the burden of becoming a man, especially by way of impregnating someone. So, if the rage that correlates your loss of innocence or childhood and your impending adulthood was caused by your penis, what's the most likely way your victim would be rendered? Again, we're talking about mirrors here. You'd create the perfect entity and symbol of peace in the sense that your victim would be an innocent child who no longer had the ability to feel emotional or physical pain, impregnate a woman, or even grow to adulthood. In short, for you it fans, the victim would float. Right there. Suspended. Forever. The way your victims were left would be directly indicative of your desires, in the same way that Edmund Kemper cut off his mother's head and slept with the body because she constantly abused him verbally and never showed him any affection. This is why I draw symbols and parallels and let people call me crazy, because I know the answers to everything are embedded in the tenuous connections of our cumulative psychology, similar to what Carl Jung believed when he told Freud to go fuck himself over philosophical differences. But to cement this notion, we need to establish one thing. Why Christopher Byers? I mean, wasn't Michael Moore the leader? Wouldn't it be him? No, the psychology dictates differently. Here's why. We're talking about mirrors, and in the context of inadequacy, you would attack the kid who reminded you most of yourself. And why? Let's go deeper, because that's what scares us most. The mirror. Is there a more difficult place to stand in judgment of yourself? Is there another instance where you can actually see all of these imaginary horrors that you feel? No. The mirror shows you what you are. That is, until you smash it because you've looked and the truth was inescapable. And if you smashed it by killing a child, you would no longer be able to see your reflection. But you would have transformed into a monster. And what do we call monsters who have no reflection and drain their victims of blood? Vampires. And what was the young man's name who, while institutionalized and elsewhere, had been repeatedly accused of trying to suck and drink the blood of others directly from their wounds, and even once allegedly smeared the blood from somebody else's wrist cutting all over his face and arms and proclaimed himself a vampire? That kid's name was Damien Eccles. And this is where the rattlesnake's tail starts to shake. This is the predator we're looking for. This is the origin. Because the clues were already apparent in his behavior. You see, before you actually smash the mirror, you tend to engage in behaviors that come pretty damn close to doing so. With that said, let's then make another parallel. The only basic qualification for looking in the mirror and hating yourself is having the courage to do it. So before Damien can reject his adulthood or similar, he first has to establish the hate of what he sees staring back at him, and then engage in a violent act that will precipitate parallels to the anger of the pregnancy causing him to remove the penis of Christopher Byers to satisfy feelings of inadequacy and the onset of adulthood. So, if you first have to see yourself in the mirror to hate yourself in a visual context, the symbolic fallout is that your eyes are to blame. Eye contact, especially with ourselves, is our greatest source of shame. And when you hate what you see, it becomes immediately apparent that the information gathered by the eyes is what makes those feelings possible. So what do you do? Well, if you're Damien Eccles, you sharpen your fingernails, attack a young man who's much like you, and try to do what? It's already embedded in the symbolism. He tried to gouge out the dude's eyes. Need more parallels? Here you go. So he goes to prison, doesn't have to raise his son, and gets out when? 18 years later, when his son has just reached adulthood. So here's your next parallel. The synergy of a single act of rage allowed Damien Eccles to simultaneously avoid every aspect of life he never wanted to live and walk out the other side a free man almost to the day he was relieved of these responsibilities. And how does he support himself now? Through fame garnered by the relentless refusal to never grow up and give in to the system, which is exactly the way every other celebrity does. And they support him because of this. He's their shadow. He's the darkness of the eclipse that would have overcome them if they ever stopped moving and believed their dreams were going to die with their youth. But how did he become free? I mean, if the things I've just outlined are actually true, and there really isn't any definitive evidence of the three's innocence to set them free, how did they mount such large and powerful PR and legal teams backed by millions of dollars contributed by some very successful people in the entertainment business? The answer is mirrors. You see, the crime that Damien allegedly committed, both literally and figuratively, was the death of childhood and innocence. And in turn, this young man, by way of being sent to prison in such an early stage of his youth as a convicted killer, also lost his childhood and innocence. And here's where that grabs empathy in large handfuls. Creative people who pretend as adults to make a living do so because they never want their childhood to die. It's evidenced in the fact that almost any creator of anything aspires to one day not have to work a mundane 9-to-5 or ride the back of a trash truck in a life where they constantly spout cliches like, "Thank God it's Friday," and "I hate Mondays," while cashing a disappointing check each week. So when people who have earned the freedom to extend their childhood into adulthood by legitimate means, such as being an actor or a director, see someone refusing to enter adulthood being imprisoned for what they believe is solely that reason, they're going to come to his aid. Because an actor, a director, and a magician are all essentially one and the same. They are all experts in one thing: sleight of hand. And what is that? At its core, fooling people into believing they saw something that was real, when in fact, it was only just an illusion. It was fantasy. And how does something, by definition, become fantastical? By removing one element: reality. And what does reality equate to in everyday life, as it pertains to perception? Truth. The people who were at the forefront of defending the West Memphis Three are artists who have dedicated their lives to shaping the perception of truth as played out through fantasy. And they defended a young man who, once again, proclaimed he wanted to be the greatest magician the world has ever known. So, accordingly, in the endeavor of doing so, documentaries were created to alter the reality in the same manner of a magician, and literally in the same way as a film director, and this is why the audience decided to suspend its disbelief in order to triumph at the end. Because this is the same deception that takes place in a movie, or at a magic show, where you walk away happy and in awe, only to have to repeat the process shortly thereafter because its emotional effects are going to fade. And why? Because it's a lie. Whether it's magic or a movie, what you were just presented didn't really happen. And you admit to yourself that you allowed your emotions to be manipulated by a mere replication of reality that is predicated entirely upon one thing, and one thing only: your willingness to believe. And when something is entirely predicated upon the willingness to believe, its legitimacy is then fully reliant upon the strength of its membership. So when engaging such a group, the question is not, what is the truth, but rather, are you willing to believe? Film directors, actors, and magicians ask this question through their work on each and every occasion they put it into the world, and the success of any piece is solely dependent on the answer to that one question: are you willing to believe? But what do we know about the work of these people? All of them have to edit their creations in order to present something as truth. It's reworked and rewritten again and again until what specific thing happens? They do these things until their work ends the way they want it to. And the foundation of this desire is believing that you have created the perception of truth, not actually replicating the true events. So, let's look at an example of that. In West of Memphis, on which Damien Echols is a producer, he claims he was on the phone at home the night of the murders from about 5 p.m. to 9:30 p.m., during which time he spoke to three different girls who can account for his whereabouts during that time. But the problem is that his attorneys never called him during his trial, according to him. He goes on to show footage of one of these girls reading her own words from a police report that suggests she talked to Damien between the hours of 5 p.m. and 9:30 p.m. on that night, so he couldn't possibly have been at the crime scene during that time. But if you step away from the magic show for a moment and into reality where omission translates to a lie, what you then find from numerous sources in less than 5 minutes research is that this scene Damien is presenting as proof of his innocence is nothing less than a total charade that is based solely upon one thing: your willingness to believe. Yet, for those who are tired of this act, of the same rabbit continuing to come out of the hat since 1993, we should note that the person who read this report in the video actually stated in her full police report that she spoke to Damien before 5:30 p.m. and then not again until 9:20, when they talked for about 10 minutes before hanging up. So, in reality, Damien can't account for these 4 hours in any other way but to manipulate the audience with edited content that promotes fantasy. This is something you can't do in court, which is why Jason Baldwin's attorney was ultimately forced to proceed in the absence of an alibi at trial. If you tell fairy tales in the courtroom, your ass is going to get in trouble very quickly with the judge. But wait a minute. We have this guy John Douglas, a well-known FBI profiler, who says we're mistaken, that the crime scene truly indicates the work of only one killer. And I agree, but in a strange kind of way. So let's break it down as it might have happened and see if we can come to any sort of definitive conclusion. Now, I don't believe there's an unknown suspect in this case, so I'm not going to approach it from an angle that introduces one. To the best of my understanding, this crime was either committed by the West Memphis Three or Terry Hobbs. I just can't find enough reason to believe otherwise. I've examined John Mark Byers to a great extent, and the one thing that keeps poking me as the truth is that the physicality of the crime is not a match. He's a large lumbering man, like a tree at a breeze, and for one man to have controlled this situation, I believe he would have had to act in a decisively aggressive and fast manner that is absolutely not consistent with his gait or any other physical traits that are evident. For instance, if you've ever played the whack-a-mole at a carnival or amusement park, try to picture John Mark Byers excelling at that game. That's the type of coordination and speed with which one would have to act. John Mark Byers is far more calculated and deliberate in his actions, even to the extent of the words that come out of his mouth. This was an explosive crime, in many respects, and not consistent with his response to anger toward a child, as evidenced by what happened earlier that day. Or perhaps it was the day before. I saw some conflicting reports on that. But, so, very strangely, this incident of violence perpetrated by John Mark Byers actually reveals the killer of the kids to be someone else, and a very specific someone else we've talked about. Check out this parallel. You see, Christopher Byers got in trouble with John Mark Byers, his adopted father, earlier that day, or the day before, because he got caught riding a skateboard belly down in the street where there were obviously moving cars around. Incensed by this, John Mark Byers whipped him with his belt and told him to never do it again. Now, I understand the initial reaction we have is that he's abusing the kid physically, and that's an indication he would do worse. But let's analyze that notion further. If John Mark Byers belts his son, whether right or wrong, he's doing so because the boy was ignorantly engaging in an activity he should have known could get him killed. In that light, what he's doing is teaching this kid that there will be severe consequences to these types of actions in the future. But what's most important here is that we understand John Mark Byers acted in the interest of preserving Christopher's life and evolutionary thrust toward adulthood and potential procreation in the process, regardless of the semantics involved. Therefore, when you examine why John Mark Byers lost control in that incident, you merely have to take out the mirror for the answer. And the reversed reflection of that truth leaves you with this: because he couldn't control. He was angry because he couldn't control his son's actions, as it not only pertains to the boy's best interests, but his basic survival. Therefore, what does he want at the core of this? John Mark Byers wants his son to live and to grow to flourish. And what does that mean? He's on our side. He stands with evolution, not against it. So, if you want me to believe that he had his teeth removed in order to not match the bite mark on Stevie Branch's face, I'm calling bullshit. Anybody looking for a definitive answer to this question is going to fail to find any type of sophisticated answer that satisfies. So if you really want to know why he had his teeth removed before the age of 40, it's this. Because West Memphis, Arkansas. For the same reason they had mullets, ample domestic violence, and dudes like Terry Hobbs. It's just backwoods dirty South. And he didn't even remove the teeth for several years after the trial anyhow. Of course, the bite mark was not construed as such during the trial in 1994, but I think that actually speaks volumes to the fact that it wasn't actually a bite mark to begin with. In fact, when the lake knife found by police behind Jason Baldwin's trailer proved to be missing its compass, and police learned that Damian Echols had a similar knife with a compass, it wasn't difficult to conclude that the cops should compare the measurements of this weapon to the injuries on Stevie Branch's face that were considered a bite mark. And of course, the measurements were a match to the butt end of the knife. And what they also reveal is that the pin on the end of the compass seems to have caused the small circular injury at the center of the alleged bite mark. So whether that happened or not, what's ultimately true is that the compass on the lake knife is missing. This means that it was either dislodged by the impact of the violent actions and lost, or it was intentionally discarded in the aftermath, whether it was knocked out or taken out. So how do we know which, and if it was even a strike from the butt end of a knife, rather than a bite? Let's take a look at the symbolism. Damian Echols was known to walk around aimlessly and endlessly while regularly carrying a survival knife in his coat, one with a compass on the butt end of the handle. And we don't carry things we never intend to use, or that lack meaning, even if it's an object we'd only utilize in an emergency. So we know that, at least subconsciously, this knife represents something for him, and specifically its relation to the compass. And whether he knew it or not, the symbolism was this. He was headed in the direction of killing somebody with that knife and burying the truth underwater, which is what he did with not only the bodies, but also the knife. And of course, that is literally what he did, as well as what happened emotionally. He had the ability to go any direction in life, symbolized by the compass he carried, and he decided to kill, which led to imprisonment, which offers no direction at all, and no ability to walk anywhere. Accordingly, where is the compass after the murders? Missing. And it's never found. And why? Because just like I've outlined above from a symbolic perspective, the compass also ties Damian to the murders physically. Now, it was already written in stone that he was going to be convicted of this crime by way of the symbolic implications of the missing compass. And that's when he watches what I've already said would happen. The truth rises to the surface. Not only in the gully with the bodies, or in the lake behind Jason Baldwin's trailer with the knife, but in the courtroom with the evidence. Okay, so now we get to something interesting that few people ever discuss, especially from the standpoint of the psychology at play in the situation. It starts with this question. Why didn't the killer, or killers, place the bikes in the water where the kids were? They would have submerged just fine, and not been detected. And what makes this really interesting is that ultimately the bikes then become inconsistent with the concealment of everything else in this crime. They are not pinned down, but simply dropped off the top of the drainage pipe that runs down the middle of the forest, where they go underwater. One bike is found on each side. So let's backtrack to the word I just used, dropped, which is how I've seen it described in several sources. So when you drop something, what are you doing? Both physically and from an emotional standpoint. You're letting go. And if you didn't bury or pin down this evidence as you had everything else, it would be fair to say that, by default, it was because you were having trouble letting go. And if you were having trouble letting go, from a symbolic standpoint, and also physically, then the object you finally drop must be representative of that thing. So, if three boys with two bikes enter the light of the magical forest of their childhood, and the sun ultimately goes down upon their youth as it comes time to leave, The abandoned bikes then become symbolic of the childhood that they so reluctantly, but ultimately, were forced to leave behind. That goes for the boys who were murdered, and also for the boys who committed the crime. So notice that these were the only memories they chose not to bury, to not try to prevent from rising to the surface. They actually separate the bikes from the bodies, which really has no practical purpose in terms of concealment. If either were to come to the surface, the entire area would be searched for everything else that might be underwater too. So why are the bikes what seems to be about 50 feet from the bodies? I mean, all the bikes are together, and all the bodies are together, but each of these groupings is separated. The answer, again, is in the symbolism of the event. What we have, literally and figuratively, is the death of childhood committed by people who are enraged because their own childhoods are dying and they have no plan to become adults. So, the logic in separating the bikes from the victims is that, again, as the bikes represent childhood, from a symbolic standpoint, the perpetrators are trying to distance themselves from the death of their childhood. There is simply no other reason to do such a thing, evidenced by the fact that, like I just said, finding even one of these things was going to lead to finding all of them pretty damn quickly. So the desire here on the guilty party is not deception, but psychological comfort. And that's something we find in abundance all over the crime scene. The boys' clothes are pinned down, and their arms and legs bound. They're hidden under the murky water, and so on. All of these things indicate suppression on the part of the killer. From an emotional standpoint, he's not only trying to keep the truth from coming to the surface in the gully, but also in his mind. And the reason we know this person is depressed is because it's obvious he wants this to happen so badly that he did everything to stop what was inevitable. The truth rising to the surface, which it always does, whether we're talking dead bodies in the water or your painful thoughts in your mind. And the psychological implications don't end there, because we have to remember that this lake knife that was supposedly involved in the crime was also dumped somewhere else, suppressed again beneath water and mud, but in a different location. And it's very telling about the truth. So where do we find the knife? Underwater behind Jason Baldwin's trailer. And what does this symbolize? That the hidden knife without compass that belonged to Damien, which is symbolic of the killing that happened due to their lack of direction in life, was a secret that Damien shared with Jason. It was a talisman, left there as a reminder to Jason. And notice that while the handle is only concealed in water, the knife's blade, which is the part that kills, is buried downward in the mud where no one can see it at all. Not even the fish. And if you look back at the murder scene, at what was used to pin things down into the mud, the answer is sharp sticks. And what do the cops believe might have caused most of the head injuries to the boys? Those same sticks. So everything utilized to cause injury in this crime was left plunged into the mud beneath water, and ultimately came to the surface. Now, I'm going to discuss more of these things at length in a future episode, including much more on Jason Baldwin and Jesse Ms. Kelly, but for now we have to talk about how these murders actually took place. By my estimation, this is what happened. The boys rode their bicycles into the forest and headed for the area of the water. This is very typical of boys to seek play areas in the woods that are centralized around bodies of water such as creeks or drainage, etc. I believe they arrived first, and were playing in some manner or another, when Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Ms. Kelly cruised past. Now, I think this wasn't quite a natural intersection of their paths, meaning that the older boys were likely drawn by the voices of the younger ones playing. Obviously, it's very difficult to ascertain exactly what happened, but I know this much for sure. I remember being a kid of this age playing in the woods, and when some of the older teens who smoked, drank, and got in trouble would come back there to do just that, I, and the rest of the little ones, were absolutely scared to death at what they might do to us, not only because of the age and size difference, but it was apparent they were angered by the onset of adulthood and looking to escape. They weren't people who were getting A's in school. So, they would trash our forts, take our bikes, and slap the backs of our heads for fun. Now, nobody ever got murdered, but the fear was still very much heightened under these circumstances. And I think that's exactly what you had here. I think a bullying incident ensued, which was initiated by Damian Eccles, a notion that is ultimately solidified by the fact that Christopher Byers got the worst of it. But how do I know this? This is what I was getting at earlier. Damien's actions are predicated upon the reflection of his fears. So if he sees himself in another, that person will become the target of his rage. So how does he see himself in Christopher Byers? Christopher was hyperactive and taking Ritalin for these issues. According to John Mark Byers, he did not take his medication that day and even might have been off it for a longer period. One element of his behavior that prompted his parents to engage such medication is that his attention deficit caused by this issue rendered him more likely to talking back to authority figures, or even just doing dangerous things like riding a skateboard face down in the street without permission, and more specifically, without worry for what the consequences might be. And I believe that it is this element, one he shared with Damian Eccles, that got him killed in that manner. I think Damian tried to strike fear in these kids, and Christopher recognized one of his own kind in the process. I believe they butted horns quickly, and without regard for consequence, leaving an outburst of sudden violence that forced Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly to make some very hasty decisions about how to handle the situation moving forward. I think, for lack of a better option, they decided to get involved and control the other two boys, because otherwise they'd run off and get everyone in trouble. And because Damian had been the leader of this pack of people who couldn't lead themselves, they simply proceeded as he did. I believe the boys were stripped, and Byers received the genital mutilation thereafter. I think that act was probably so horrifying in nature, in terms of his reaction and the totality of the visual, that it rendered all three of the boys screaming, at which point they were beaten in the face and head with heavy sticks and the butt of Damien's knife to shut them up, which then rendered them all unconscious, with Christopher Byers now dying from his injury. At this point, I think Jason and Jesse are in absolute shock that this has happened, and I sincerely believe it's possible Jason has blocked the truth from his mind by simply continuing to assert he's innocent without so much as an alibi. Jesse, of course, admits he was drunk and was even allegedly diagnosed with what is now known as PTSD in the aftermath of the crime. But once the first kid is dead and the other two are beaten unconscious, you're already looking at a life sentence. So as crushing as it is, I believe Stevie Branch and Michael Moore, who had been determined to be alive when they were placed in the water, were basically mercy kills where they just drifted into death as they were unconscious and deprived of oxygen. So this is what I was discussing earlier in the context of the speed and physicality of the crime. It doesn't match John Mark Byers. Now, I believe the incident could have been longer than this. It's just that the violence erupted quickly. And of course, this crime could match Terry Hobbs, and he's going to be featured in a later episode. But for now, it's fair to say that this is an exact match to the capabilities of the West Memphis Three. And that profiler John Douglas is right about finding one killer. There were three guilty parties here, but only one true madman, only one predator. Because every group operates as a unit, with a head, a body, and a tail. But the head is always the part that makes the decisions. It's the part that has fangs. It's the part that lashes out. And the part that contains the venom with the power to kill. The body and the tail simply follow along in service of the head's desires. This is Damian Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly. It's the power of three and the anatomy of a rattlesnake.